Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to More Than Amused Podcast, a podcast all about women and the arts, hosted by Stani and Sadie.
Join us as we explore what it's like being a female artist, examine modern day problems, and educate ourselves and you on important and forgotten female artists of the past.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to More Than Amused. I'm Stani.
I'm Sadie, and thank you for joining us for another edition of our March Madness episodes. Thanks for being here. Happy March.
Thank you so much. Just a reminder, our merch is still available at morethanamusedpodcast.com until the end of the year. A lot of people have been receiving their orders this week, which has been so exciting. So definitely go check it out.
I've been quite thrilled seeing people. Shout out to everyone who's tagged us in their stories and shared it. It's just so cool to see it out in the wild.
I know. It's so fun. Especially because, like, we've had them for a while, so I, like, forget the fact that it's everyone new. Hasn't had theirs, and then they get it, and I'm like, oh, yay.
Yeah.
No. So, no, it's been really fun.
Exactly. This is coming out on a Friday, and, yeah, through the rest of March, if you want to hop on it, go hop on it. Also, I'm actually going to move my laptop here. We're going to experiment with that. I just moved into a new apartment, which is exciting, but now I'm trying to figure out our new setup.
Totally fair.
We are fiddling a little bit, but I have done a lot of research for this episode. This is my episode basically for the month to talk about books and music and the feminine rage themes that can be found there. Before we dive into it, is there anything that we need to touch on or any current trending pop culture moments?
I'm trying to think if there's anything that has come up recently. I actually feel like this week has been relatively quiet.
It has been quiet. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like, March Madness is going on in the sports world, so my office is running a live stream constantly of all the basketball.
The only March Madness I care about is our March Madness.
I know, right? Theirs didn't even start until halfway through March.
Boring.
Where ours started on the March 1st.
Interesting. Well,
also, I wanted to make a quick reminder. We've had double episodes this whole month. I feel like a few people haven't noticed.
Truly.
Yeah. Yeah. Because our Monday episodes are getting some listens and then people are missing the Friday ones. Every single week this entire month, we've had two episodes come out. Go check those out if you missed them.
Yeah. And this week's and last week's, we had awesome guests that were able to join us and talk to us about feminine rage themes in visual media last week with Hal Rockefeller. Mm-hmm. And then this week with Emily from the New Nine, we talked about music and it was great fun. So
much fun.
Loved those episodes.
Yeah. Same.
And now today we're just doing the two of us and talking more nitty gritty, more art recommendations to learn about feminine rage. I'm not going to lie that I feel like with both forms of media that I'm covering, I had like opposite problems.
Interesting.
Where like opposite problems in the sense, I don't want to say that there aren't books about feminine rage because of course there is. But when I was going through like the classics, I was like, no, I want like an angry woman. And I felt like I was really having to like dial in my Google searches to find things. Mm. I found a lot of things about like crazy women, which like we'll talk about, and mentally ill women, to be honest.
Yeah.
Or like women that were in tumultuous relationships. But I didn't necessarily find as many mad women. What was interesting though is there were a lot of people who wrote about the typical revengeful woman, but they were written by men. And I didn't want those books to be the focus of what I was going to be highlighting because I was like,
so interesting. I wonder if a lot of it comes from the fact that like anger for so long hasn't been an acceptable emotion for women.
Yeah, I don't know either. And also maybe someone's listening and they're like, no, you idiot, you didn't think of this or this. Which, okay, I will take the critique. The books that I had originally thought of, though, that I was like, oh, maybe this could be something, was like Carrie, but that's Stephen King. Mm-hmm. There was also Carmilla, which was like the first vampire woman. That was before Dracula, like lesbian vampire gothic novel. But that was written by a man. So I was like, wow, all of these angry women, and they were written by men. How dare they? But I still was able to find some good ones that I'm excited about. And the opposite problem with music is that there's literally so many.
So many.
This whole month could have been based off of music.
Oh, literally.
That focus on feminine rage. We couldn't do that. And I tried to find and pull stories that were not just what we talked about earlier this week with Emily. But there's going to be some repeat because some of them are just like the stories are too good that I was like, okay, we mentioned them in the episode earlier this week, but let me now tell you the story behind the scenes.
I just had a thought pop into my head. I was thinking like classic literature, angry woman. And I immediately thought of Anne of Green Gables breaking the slate over Gilbert Blythe's head.
That is such a good one. Oh my gosh.
Yes. I'm sure there's more instances, but I feel like she's the epitome of teen girl anger in the classics. Okay. Maybe like a Jo March too.
Yes.
But you're right. Like, it's not as obvious. I feel like it's much more hidden.
It's so much more hidden and is what I noticed. And because some things were like, oh, Jane Eyre by the Bronte sisters and Wuthering Heights. And
they're more depressed than angry.
They're more depressed than angry.
Yeah.
And granted, they are a lot of the times angry about the situations and they're angry about their place in society. But it's almost interesting how it's the way that character acts, though, in the novel. Granted, I haven't read Jane Eyre. I have a copy of it. I haven't read it yet.
Yeah.
But I was reading summaries online and I was just like, it was all about like how she was sad and depressed. Yeah. And I thought that was interesting that a lot of what I was finding was that. The one book that I did read, though, specifically in preparation for this episode was The Bell Jar. Have you ever read The Bell Jar?
I have a copy. I haven't had time, but I literally have a copy on my shelf.
I relate to that. I have so many copies on my shelf of books that I could read. But I read that one in preparation for it. And that one was actually pretty similar, where it was a depressed girl that was angry about a lot of things. But actually, the main focus was like her deteriorating mental health. And so it was interesting.
Tough.
Genuinely.
Yeah.
Tough.
Not relatable at all.
That was the problem with The Bell Jar for me. First off, it's a sad read. The main character is frustrating, but also I'm like, I get what you're saying. Like, I'm feeling like the paralyzed by indecisiveness, this like feeling like there's no point to anything. I've been there. Yeah. Esther is her name. But at the same time, she drove me crazy. And I was just like, ah.
It also makes me like,
I drive myself crazy when I'm depressed.
It makes me so sad though, because I'm like, oh, get her some Celexa, you know? Like, she would have been so fun. Wasn't there like a trend going around earlier where it was like, rip so-and-so, you would have loved this?
Yeah.
And I swear I saw rip Sylvia Plath, you would have loved antidepressants.
That's so brutal.
I know.
But yes, I have seen that. And it is pretty funny. Anyways, without any further ado, I'm going to talk about some books. And you know what? Considering the fact that it was maybe a little bit harder for me to find ones that were like jarringly like angry women, I did find a couple that had come out in the last 5 to 10 years that I'm like, that sounds really interesting. So cool. I have a couple modern examples that I'll be leaning in. And then you really structured your episode of the different tenets of feminine rage. I just have 5 books that I'm just going to provide some context for. And then I honestly don't remember how many stories about songs I have. I think I have around 5, but
yeah.
But also I have a rapid fire list for both books and movies that are like, we could have talked about and gone into more, but we didn't. Anyways, I'm going to start actually with something that is written by a man, but I think is like a great place to start if we're talking about feminine rage in literature, which is Medea, which is an ancient Greek tragedy written by Euripides. Is that how you say that? Euripides.
Euripides? Yeah,
Euripides. Oh, I swear we are well educated on this podcast.
Oh,
but
man.
It is based on the myth of Jason and Medea. It was first produced in 431 BC, old, as part of a trilogy. And the two other plays have not survived. So they just have the first part of this. But the plot centers on the actions of Medea, who was a former princess on the kingdom of Colchis and the wife of Jason. And she finds her position in the Greek world threatened because Jason leaves her for a Greek princess of Corinth. And she takes vengeance on Jason by murdering his new wife as well as her own two sons, after which she escapes to Athens to start a new life. Which I just was like, there it is. Yeah. Female rage. The birthplace of it.
Isn't there like a modern novel about it too?
Ooh, let me check. We read Circe.
Yeah, which I know is based on her. I thought there was one like that for Medea. Maybe I'm thinking of Circe instead.
I just Googled it really quick and there is like Medea, a novel. I don't recognize it, but maybe it's one that's like really popular. So if anyone knows of a good retelling of the story of Medea.
Yeah, that would be cool.
I would love a recommendation of it.
Not that I don't want to read an ancient Grecian play, but...
But I have a feeling the current retelling could be more interesting.
Yeah. Did you have to read... Yeah, you were in that class, Honors English, where we had to read, like, that really old
like
Grecian...
Like, where the Oedipus epic. Complex came from?
Yeah.
But there was also another one that we had
to
read.
Yeah, we read two.
Did we have to read something from
yes,
the Iliad? Yes,
we read the Iliad.
Again, see, we're very well educated on this podcast.
I read the Iliad in 10th grade.
You're a really smart Stani.
Yeah. And the abridged Les Mis.
I wanted to start with that as like mm-hmm. the baseline point, just because I thought it was really cool to find something from literature that was literally from 400 BC. Wasn't written by a woman, but we'll forgive it because there's the original from the Greek myth. Anyways, let's now transition to the bell jar that I'm going to talk a little bit more about. So it's actually the only novel that was written by the American writer Sylvia Plath. She wrote a lot of poems, but this was her one novel. And it was actually originally published under the pseudonym Victoria Lucas in 1963. And this novel is semi-biographical with just like the names and the places changed. It's actually regarded as a roman a clef because the protagonist's descent into mental illness parallels her own experience with what may have been clinical depression or bipolar 2 disorder. And so Sylvia Plath actually died by suicide a month after it first was published in the UK. And it was published under her own name for the first time in 1967, but was not published in the United States until 1971. But now the book is very huge and very read and has been translated into dozens of languages. Very popular. The basic plot of the book starts with the main character who is in New York for the summer. She has some type of scholarship where she's essentially working as an intern for a writing for some company. I'm going to get the nitty-gritty details probably ruined, but like she wants to be a poet, she wants to be a writer, and it starts with like her adventures in New York, but then also a lot of like the way she's viewing the other women and the other girls that she is living with at the time, and like they're all out dating and is getting excited, and she's I don't want to say she's judgmental, mm-hmm. but like she's got a lot of opinions about the women and like is disenchanted by it all. She has a boyfriend. She kind of has a boyfriend named Buddy that she tells stories about how she would go visit him while he was in college. But then she finds out that he lost his virginity and had an affair with some woman working in the summer. And that really bothers her because she feels like he's a hypocrite now, where he like puts on a face and like, expects purity from her. But then he wasn't willing to uphold by those same standards. And so she like struggles with like feeling obligated to marry him because he proposes to her and all this. And then, yeah, there's so many different layers and the story is told like slightly confusing just because there's a lot of like flashbacks that are happening with the real time. So it's like hard to know what's happening in this moment and what's just like something she's thinking about. But at the end of her summer in New York, she goes to a party where someone sets her up with someone and he attempts to... trigger warnings, obviously, but I guess unfortunately, like, we're talking about the bell jar, I think some of that is implied, and also spoiler alerts for a lot of these books.
Spoilers for all of it.
Except for the ones I haven't read, because some of the books I was like, wait, I actually want to read it, I don't want to look up everything that happens. Anyways, but she goes to a party, she's set up with a guy, he attempts to rape her, she breaks his nose and gets out of that situation. She ends up moving home back with her mother. And she really falls into a depression because she thought she was going to get a certain scholarship that she ended up not getting. So she wasn't welcome into the class. And she really just like struggles with knowing what to do for the summer. And then in that, she just really sinks deep into a deep depression. And they try to take her to a therapist where she gets electroshock therapy that obviously is a traumatic experience because it would be a traumatic experience. And so she does take a lot of pills, overdoses. She survives, but then they check her into a facility and it just talks about her time there and like all of her processing that's going on. She meets a therapist there that she actually really likes. She actually meets an old friend that she knew from home that she actually never really liked in the first place named Joan, and they awkwardly rekindle their relationship because she just doesn't like her, but Joan actually really loves her. That's what like some people theorize, that Joan was actually a lesbian and really liked Esther, but that Esther did not give those feelings back to her. Just some things that I was reading about online, trying to see what other people were thinking about the novel. At a certain point in the book, she goes to a doctor to get some type of birth control so that she can no longer have the stress of everything that's implied with being a woman and getting pregnant. And she goes and she meets a guy and she loses her virginity and some like weird freak accident happens and she ends up bleeding like a lot, like hemorrhaging after that.
From sex?
Yes. Which like I Googled it because I was like, what happened to her? And all that's like it said is that it's like some just like weird freak accident that happened. I think that it's maybe more symbolic of what happened to her. But
so she's not like actually possible.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I don't know if this works like that. Actually possible, because there's a lot of myths about the hymen breaking, and like sometimes girls do bleed,
but it doesn't cause a hemorrhaging.
But you're not bleeding out.
No.
Yeah, I don't know exactly. Again, like I tried to Google it and it didn't give me like a, oh, it was just this specific diagnosis. It was more of just, oh, it was just a freak accident. But she goes to a doctor, she tells what happens, and then he's, oh, yep, this is rare, but it happens. He fixes her up. She goes back to the doctor and talks about what happens. And then the book ends with her going to have a meeting with a group of doctors that basically are going to clear her to get out of the facility to go start life again. And you just assume, and it's definitely very heavily implied, that she's doing better and that she is going to go out in the world again. I will say it's interesting because she is getting better, but at the same time, she's not necessarily better. You know what I mean? And it was an interesting look into the way that they would deal with mental health problems then, because she did multiple rounds of electroshock therapy. They even did a type of treatment where they would give her insulin. And
that's so like, weird.
I know. So she like talks about how like, she gained a lot of weight because they were giving her insulin. I don't know. It's obviously now been disproven as like an effective way to help mental illness. So it was interesting to read about how far we've come in that way. But I want to talk about some of the plots. And I'm not going to lie. I went on just like literature Reddit page and there was a comment that I just loved. And so I'll tell you when, but like one of the things I am reading, yes, it is literally a Reddit comment, but I love think that it summed it up. Obviously, though, one of the main themes is mental health and as far as what the bell jar is. So Esther describes her life as being suffocated by a bell jar. And what a bell jar is, a thick glass container sometimes used to create a vacuum space. And here it stands for Esther's mental health suffocation by the unavoidable settling of depression. Yeah. And throughout the novel, she talks about how it's suffocating her and recognizes moments of clarity when it's lifted. These moments correlate to her mental state and the effect of her depression.
If you're having a hard time imagining what a bell jar looks like, it is the golden case that goes over the top of the rose in Beauty and the Beast.
Cute. Yes. That is very helpful, actually.
Yeah.
I love that visual.
Yep.
Exactly. So people argue about what is the bell jar? What is the thing that is suffocating to her? Some say it's, oh, it's her retaliation against suburban life. Other people believe it's just standards that are set on women's life, period.
It's womanhood.
It's just womanhood or just mental illness and depression, period. Maybe that's all that the bell jar represents, is just like how suffocating depression can be. Womanhood, though, just in general, is such a theme of this novel because it's like her whole quest to forge her own identity. And because she really struggles with the fact of, oh, I feel this pressure that like he wants to marry me, but I don't know if I just want to be a wife, because she is expected to become a housewife, but also be a very self-sufficient woman, but not really have the ability to achieve anything on her own. She feels she's a prisoner to domestic duties and she fears the loss of her inner self. And throughout the novel, she just like really internally muses about sex, virginity, and just the expectations of her as a woman. And like I said, a major plot point in the later chapters of the book is that she is provided a contraceptive implant by a doctor, which allows her to lose her virginity without fear of falling pregnant, and thus expected to become a parent before her time. Because earlier in the novel, like I said, she criticizes the double standards of the expectation that she remains a virgin for Buddy, who wants to marry her, while he was able to have casual sexual relationships with another woman earlier in his life without any consequences. And she felt very bitter about it. Now I'm going to read to you this whole Reddit comment because I thought it was great. So the whole point is that it's Sylvia's own personal hell. Esther is a stand-in for Plath, obviously. And through Esther, we learn that she hates anything that invokes gender stereotype. She wants to be a free woman. She even states this when she's at the senator's apartment, quote, "I wanted to be a 4th of July rocket going in every directions." It's why she's so fascinated by Doreen and yet disgusted by her. Doreen acts as a foil to Esther. Doreen is like one of the girls that she hangs out with a lot in New York. Also, her own indecisiveness causes her to fall into a huge depression. The most famous scene of the book is in the fig tree. She has all these possibilities that she can reach out and touch, but knows that going to one will cause all the others to cease. In the end, she rather be where she's at than doing something different if it means she can't do it all at once. Another key theme is the hatred of the maternal. When Esther returns home, her depression becomes physical, no longer able to write, not showering, and a suicide attempt. Being home with her mother reminds her of all the things she's trying to run away from, and she can't escape it. Then there's the end, the meeting to get out of the asylum. Obviously she does, but is she really cured? No. The story is told retroactively, everything happening in the book in the past. The only thing that we can inquire about the Esther in the present is that, one, she got out of the asylum, two, she never escaped her gender role and became a mother, and three, her attitude never changed about the things that she hated. When you take all of this and know that this is not just a character, but Sylvia herself, it becomes quite sad.
Yeah.
Which, again, it mirrored a lot. And even though events and things were changed, I even read about the fact that certain hospitals that she went to, the therapist in the book was a very much reflection of the therapist that she went to herself. So it was interesting though to read though and just realize, oh, this book came out in the 60s and 70s, but it's something that I do relate to, and it's something that like I'm working through actually right now, is like, why do I feel resentful of being a woman and like following in like certain paths? Like, why is this something that stresses me out? And I don't know. We talked about it a couple months ago when we interviewed for the book Secret Voices with the years of journal entries from people. And it's just really interesting how the plight of women is unfortunately very consistent.
Yeah.
It's just very tragic.
Oof. No, I've heard the like fig tree allegory before and read about that. But yeah, I definitely want to read the whole book at some point.
It was a bit of a downer.
I know. That's been holding me back a little bit. I do have another one that's just like her collected poems. And I think I might start with that first.
That seems like a good place to start.
Yeah, it feels a little bit more digestible.
I think so.
Yeah. But who can – I feel like everyone can relate to the idea of wanting to be everything and nothing.
Exactly. Literally.
Yeah.
The next book I'm going to talk about is The Handmaid's Tale, which is a TV show. I've actually never seen the TV show, but I did read the book years ago.
I think I watched the full first season.
Okay.
It's dark, obviously, because the concept's dark.
It's pretty dark.
Yes. Yeah. So it was like a little too much. But I mean, pretty relevant.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
If you don't know what The Handmaid's Tale is about, it's a futuristic dystopian novel by Margaret Atwood. It was published in 1985. Mm-hmm. It is set in a very near future New England patriarchal totalitarian state known as the Republic of Gilead, which has overthrown the United States government. Ofred. I've only read it.
I remember.
Whatever.
Yeah, one of those. Either one.
is the central character and the narrator of the book, and is one of the handmaids, which is women who are forcibly assigned to produce children for their commanders, who are the ruling class. And the novel explores themes of just powerless women in a patriarchal society, loss of female agency and individuality, and suppression of women's reproductive rights. The story is told in the first person by this woman. And in this era of environmental pollution and radiation, she's one of the few remaining fertile women. Therefore, she is one of the ones who is assigned to have babies and is known as a handmaid.
Yeah, it's weird because they justify it all with the Bible. They have Abraham take Sarah's handmaid because Sarah's barren. So that's, they read that before. And then they call them Mary and Martha's, playing off of, we did that whole thing about how Mary was seen as the pure woman. So they all dress in blue and those are the wives. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then the Marthas are in red and they're the handmaids. It's sickening, honestly, how distorted they make it all.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, like you said, they all wear certain things based off of the Marthas or the cooks and the maid and possibly sterile women's and green, and the wives are the in blue, and the handmaids wear red. It's very creepy. But I wanted to talk about where this book came from, because reading through these, and especially with the songs and things, that I was like, okay, maybe the character doesn't actually read angry necessarily, but the author is very angry. And I feel like that is like an interesting distinction. Fitting with her statements that Handmaid's Tale is a work of speculative fiction, not science fiction. The novel is intended to be a satirical view of various social, political, and religious trends in the United States in the 80s. And her motivation for writing the novel was her belief that in the 80s, the religious right was discussing what they would do with two women if they took power, including the Moral Majority, the Christian Coalition, and the Ronald Reagan administration. She questions what would happen if these trends, and especially casually held attitudes about women, were taken to their logical end. She argues that all the scenarios offered in The Handmaid's Tale have actually occurred in real life. In an interview she gave regarding her later novel, Oryx and Crake, she maintains that, as with The Handmaid's Tale, I didn't put anything that we haven't already done, we're not already doing, and therefore the amount of pure invention is close to nil. Atwood was known to carry around newspaper clippings to her various interviews to support her fiction's basis in reality. She explained that Handmaid's Tale is a response to those who say the oppressive, totalitarian, and religious governments that have taken hold in other countries throughout the years can't happen here. But in this work, she has tried to show how such a takeover might play out. We talked about that. When did we talk about that? Oh, more recently, just earlier this month, where we, like, a lot of the times it's so easy to separate ourselves from evil and say, no, that could never happen to us. But in actuality, unfortunately, every society, we're never past the point where, oh, nothing bad could happen to us.
Yeah, no, I think it's a lot closer than people think. I hate the whole premise of that book. I think it was so necessary, and I'm glad she wrote it so early on, especially with more modern things. I feel like we see how it could be even more applicable, but
is so right.
It's so horrific.
It really is. And then what I thought was interesting is her representation for the Republic of Gilead came from her own study of American Puritans. While at Harvard, she argues that the modern view of the Puritans, that they came to America to flee religious persecution in England and just set up religious tolerantly society, is misleading, and that instead these Puritan leaders wanted to establish a monolithic theonomy where religious dissent would not be tolerated. And what's crazing is that she has a personal connection to the Puritans, that she dedicates the novel to her own ancestor, Mary Webster, who was accused of witchcraft in Puritan New England but survived her hanging.
Oh, gosh.
I know. Ugh. Another crazy thing. So the American Library Association lists Handmaid's Tale as number 37 on the 100 most frequently challenged books from 1990 to 2000. In 2019, it's actually still listed as the 7th most challenged book because of profanity, vulgarity, and sexual overtones. Yeah, that's why. This is crazy. So in May 2022, Atwood announced that in a joint project undertaken with Penguin Random House, that they created an unburnable copy of the book that would be produced and auctioned off. And the project intended to stand as a powerful symbol against censorship. So on June 7th of 2022, the unique unburnable copy was sold in New York for $130,000.
What does it look like? I feel like I need to look at this.
Looks like a book. I Googled the thing too because I was so confused by it. But like, it's a book. It just looks like
a
book.
They make it unburnable.
I have no idea.
It's just paper.
I know, but it's technically unburnable. I don't necessarily know why.
Man, can we do that with every book that's been banned? I know. Make one copy unburnable.
Thought that was cool.
Yeah. That is really cool.
A couple more things about what she said about the themes. So obviously a lot of the discussion about The Handmaid's Tale has been centered around, like, it's a feminist literature book, but something that she said is that she does not see the Republic of Gilead as a purely feminist dystopia, as not all men have greater rights than women. Instead, the society presents a typical dictatorship, quote, shaped like a pyramid with the powerful of both sexes at the apex, the men generally outranking the women at the same level, then descending levels of power and status with men and women in each, mm-hmm. all the way down to the bottom where the unmarried men must serve in the ranks before being awarded an econo-wife. Atwood has argued that while some of the observations that inform the content of The Handmaid's Tale may be feminist, her novel is not meant to say one thing to one person or serve as a political message. Instead, The Handmaid's Tale is a study of power and how it operates and how it deforms or shapes the people who are living within that kind of regime.
No, I feel like they did a good job of that in the show, because they definitely show that, like, the Marys or the wives are just as distorted in their mm-hmm. viewpoints as their husbands. And even though they're mistreated by their husbands, they then turn around and mistreat
the other
people. The people lower than them, and like that pyramid of corruptible power. Yeah, I totally get what she's saying there. It also freaks me out because it makes me think so hard about, like, how far would our world go if less women were fertile, and so it wasn't like, would they get to the point where they start forcing people to have children so that we don't die out?
Well, that's
the premise it shares, is that it's like, would you reach that point? Like,
at what point would we need to make sure that people are having kids? Interesting, though.
To the point where they regulate it in order to make sure it happens in the way they want to, where it's like, anyway, terrifying.
Very interesting. I want to, like I said, rapid fire some classics. And then I'm going to talk about give you the basic plots for some newer books if you want to explore a more recent thing. One is Rebecca, which is one that kind of female hysteria, I think, is maybe more of a theme there. I just got a copy of that, so I'm excited to read it, but I've seen the movie. We've talked about it. Again, some of these books, too, I'm like, we've already talked about this.
Yeah.
So Gone Girl, we have a whole episode on Gone Girl.
Yeah.
Carrie by Stephen King, which, like, actually could be a good future episode idea, is, like, the way that men write angry women versus, like, how women do it.
Oh, definitely.
Nightwood by Juna Barnes, and I do have a episode that I did, I think, last summer about her. Carmilla, Jane Eyre, We Have Always Lived in This Castle by Shirley Jackson, and then a book that a friend actually recommended to me is called Something in the Water, which is more of like a thriller thing. She was thinking something like adjacent to Gone Girl, so that's not necessarily classic associated, but another one to check out. Some premises for some more recent books. So there's a book called A Certain Hunger. It's a debut novel that was written by Chelsea G. Summers. Is the story of a serial killer named Dorothy Daniels that is a successful food writer who also eats men. And this was published in December 2020. This was in New York Times, a quote about it from Amy Silverberg, noted, "The feminist argument conveyed by the murderous protagonist, why is it that women have been kept out of so many industries, including Patrick Bateman-style serial murders? Because, Dorothy thinks, people don't want to believe women can do the job. Feminism comes to all things, she says, but it comes to recognizing homicidal rage the slowest."
We talked about why that's the author wrote Gone Girl, too, was for that same reason, that people don't think women are capable of stuff like that.
Yeah.
Have you seen that tweet going around that it's like, there's a study released that psychologists are realizing that more women are psychopaths than they thought?
Oh,
and then someone commented underneath and they said, "Awesome, I love to see women excelling in men-dominated fields."
Well, I feel like this book is kind of there for that. Yeah. That is like that tweet.
Yep.
Another one is someone named Josephine Livingston also emphasized this dimension of the novel, saying it complicates ironic misandry shtick and transforms it into something complicated and engaging. Instead of conventional rape revenge plot, the precision and passion Dorothy bring to murder have a strong relation to her obsession with food. She has an intense sexual relationship with a kosher butcher, for example. I'm interested in that.
Yeah, I'm like, wow. Mm-hmm. She dates a butcher, but she's a cannibal. This cannibal. Is so weird.
Women can be serial killers too. I'm a feminist. Another one is a book called Night Bitch by Rachel Yoder. The like tagline is, one day the mother was a mother, but then one night she was quite suddenly something else. And this is the premise, is an ambitious mother puts her art career on hold to stay at home with her newborn son, but the experience does not match her imagination. 2 years later, she steps into the bathroom for a break from her toddler's demand, only to discover a dense patch of hair on the back of her neck. In the mirror, her canine suddenly looks sharper than she remembers. Her husband, who travels for work 5 days a week, casually dismisses her fear from a faraway hotel rooms. And then as the mother's symptoms intensify and her temptation to give in to her new dog impulses peak, she struggled to keep her alter canine identity secret. Seeking a cure at the library, she discovers the mysterious academic tome, which becomes her Bible, a field guide to magical women, a mythical ethnography, and meets a group of mommies involved in a multi-level marketing scheme who may also be more than what they seem.
Oh my gosh. MLMs.
I read that and I was like, oh boy. And I get it's like the rage and like the issues of becoming a mother and like putting things on hold.
Yeah, that's actually like a really funny thing, and like how an MLM is promising you escape from that. Like so many people are like, you could work from home. MLM.
Literally. Yeah,
that's funny.
I know. So that was one I was very intrigued by. And then the last one I've actually seen a little bit on TikTok. It's called Bunny. Mm-hmm. And it's a 2019 novel by Mona Awad, which Vogue, the New York Public Library, and Time named one of the best books of 2019. The author is actually a graduate of Brown's University's Literary Arts program, and it's like a satirical on like academia and creative writing. The story uses a clique of mean girls and magical realism to demonstrate the fantastical drama that can occur in elite or supposedly elite spaces. The book touches on themes like hybridity and art versus reality. And the main character is Samantha Mackey, who's a 25-year-old fiction writer seeking an MFA in creative writing at the prestigious Warren University. She's part of the narrative arts department, and so are four other young women: Creepy Doll, Kira, Cupcake, Caroline, Vignette, Victoria, and the Duchess Eleanor. And the four women form a powerful clique of mean girls called the Bunnies by mixing cuteness, sex, and violence. They call each other Bunny, and Samantha and her best friend and staunch nonconformist Ava think the Bunnies are disturbing and cultish.
Interesting.
That was also one that popped up a lot when I Googled feminine rage books. There were also a lot of nonfiction books, by the way, that come up when you look up like feminine rage, but wanted to focus on novels. So there's just a little taste into some of that. Now I'm going to talk about some music.
Let's do it.
As a musician, this is what I've been excited for. So I wanted to start out with just rapid firing some albums that are associated a lot with feminine rage. One of them is Lemonade by Beyonce. If I Can't Have Love, I Want Power by Halsey. Back to Black by Amy Winehouse, I think is a good one. Fetch the Bolt Cutters by Fiona Apple. And I think Fiona Apple in general is associated with the early 90s angsty angry woman. And then Jagged Little Pill by Alanis Morissette are all albums that have a lot of things with those themes. But here's some songs and some stories behind the songs. Okay, the first one I want to talk about is a song called You Don't Own Me by Leslie Gore, which if you've been to the Eras Tour, it's one of the last songs that plays before Taylor takes the stage.
Oh, you I didn't don't realize own that me. Those were planned. Interesting.
Yes. So I'm pretty sure it's the very last song that plays before Taylor Swift takes the stage.
Cool.
Which is pretty cool. So it's a 1963 hit by 17-year-old Leslie Gore. I want to talk about this girl, like future episode coming. She's the one who did the song like, it's my party.
Okay.
If I want to. Yes. Yeah. There's also a song called Judy's Turn to Cry. Have you ever heard that song?
I don't think so.
You should look up Judy's Turn to Cry after this. I actually never heard the song, and a couple of months ago, my mom sent it to me. It was like, have you heard this? And I listened and I was laughing so hard. The song's so iconic. It's hilarious. But her earlier songs mostly concerned boys getting dumped by boys or getting approval by boys, bragging about the boys who liked her, all of that. But an interview, actually that happened in 1991, 30 years after, she recalled that when You Don't Own Me first came to her attention, she said, at the time, I know I chose it because I know I like the strength in the lyric. But for me, it was not a song about being a woman. It was about being a person and what was involved with that. Of course, it got picked up as an anthem for women, which makes me very proud. And this has been a song that has been used a lot as women's empowerment. Apparently, like, the female cast of Saturday Night Live sang the song with Jessica Chastain the night of the 2018 Women's March.
Oh, cool.
What I thought was interesting, though, is that this song was actually originally written by two men, but I really still love the story behind it. So I wanted to shout them out. And like, I love the fact, like, they would be okay that it's been turned into this feminist anthem. Mm-hmm. So David White and John Madera are the ones who wrote it. And John Madera is now 82 years old, but he was interviewed and he says that the two songwriters were disgusted by how much music written for female singers in the early 60s centered on mooning over guys and decided to try something. Quote, let's write a song about a woman telling a guy off.
We love feminists.
I know.
Ally.
Madera says the song's sensibility was also shaped by his upbringing in a multiracial Philadelphia neighborhood and his own participation in the civil rights movement. Quote, I saw how Black people got treated. It was horrible. Mm-hmm. My friends and I got locked up in Philadelphia and Mississippi, and they treated us like gangsters. And my Black friends got hit more than I got hit. The police had billy clubs and hit you across the legs, but the Black guys I was friends with got hit across the body. And those are things you just don't forget.
Yeah.
Another thing that he talks about as far as the composition goes is that the minor key of the verses underscores that sense of risk of standing up to power, but that there is power in the phrasing. The song is made up entirely of declarative sentences. There are no ellipses, no question marks whatsoever. She is not mixing messages. You understand what she is saying from line one.
Love that.
Which I thought was really cool. And for some of the lyrics, if you don't know them, I won't read the whole song to you, but it opens. You don't own me. I'm not just one of your mini toys. You don't own me. Don't say I can't go with other boys. And don't tell me what to do. And don't tell me what to say. And please, when I go out with you, don't put me on display. Because you don't own me. Don't try to change me in any way. You don't own me. Don't tie me down. Because I never stay.
Nice.
I thought the lyrics, the story behind it was like good. Like two men were like, that's stupid. We should write a song. And Leslie Gore took it. And it became huge. I loved it. The next song I'm going to shout out is Just a Girl by...
I'm like, isn't Just a Girl like the I'm just a girl.
Just a Girl by No Doubt.
Yeah.
Oh, no, not that one.
Oh.
But it's I'm just a girl.
Oh, that's right.
That's the TikTok trend.
I'm thinking of I'm just a kid and life is a nightmare.
And my life's a nightmare. Yes.
Gotcha. Okay.
It fits though.
Yeah.
So story of Just a Girl by No Doubt. Gwen Stefani talked about in a recent interview talked about it because she was originally with No Doubt before she went on as a solo artist. And she said, I just literally started songwriting. I didn't even know that I knew how to songwrite, she recalled. My parents were quite strict with me and I was living at home even into my 20s and I would have to come home and knock my parents' door. And it was frustrating because I was already like older. And that's what inspired her to originally pen the lyrics. She says, I can remember thinking, wow, I'm in the car right now. I'm driving home. It's like 1 a.m. And if something did happen to me, I'm vulnerable because I'm a girl. And you start to think, wow, maybe people actually look at me different because I am a female. I just wanted to write a song to express how I was feeling in that moment, and I never in my wildest dreams thought anyone would hear it. But Just a Girl was No Doubt's second successful single behind 1994 Squeal, and the band had been together for 8 years before they skyrocketed to fame with their third album, Tragic Kingdom, which featured Just a Girl as the first single. Quote, the song has been incredible and I remember coming up with every line. I have a really bad memory, but I really remember that moment and feeling I could really relate to myself and the song. I felt like it really echoed exactly how I felt. And then saying, I think that when I do that song now, I still feel like it represents, it's beyond an age. It just represents a feeling. So I feel really proud of it. And it Just a Girl has turned into a TikTok trend of like almost like being cute and girly, but I want to read some of the words to you so you understand exactly what's happening in the song, where it's, take this pink ribbon off my eyes, I'm exposed, and it's no big surprise, don't you think I know exactly where I stand, the world is forcing me to hold your hand, because I'm just a girl, a little old me, don't let me out of your sight, oh, I'm just a girl, all pretty and petite, so don't let me have any rights. Mm-hmm. The moment I step outside, so many reasons for me to run and hide, I can't do the little things I hold so dear, because it's all those little things that I fear.
It's one of those songs that I never realized was feminist. And then you read the lyrics and you're like, oh.
That's what that is.
Yeah.
I also want to talk about the song Respect by Aretha Franklin. So it was actually originally written by Otis Redding and recorded, but something that I thought was cool is that there's pretty two distinct differences on it. One of them first is that they added a lot of backup vocals in Aretha Franklin's version, but they also added the iconic spelling of R-E-S-P-E-C-T to the chorus, which I think personally makes the song
100%.
Yes, and her version of the song and the way she sang it definitely really made it into the powerful empowerment anthem that it has become. Mm-hmm. It's Aretha Franklin's signature song. It became a soundtrack for the racial and gendered politic movements of its time when it was released in 1967. And what I think was really cool is that she was aware of its power and said that, quote, it depicted the need of a nation and added that it was a monumental significance. And here's the full quote. It reflected the need of a nation, the need of average men and women in the street, the businessman, the mother, the fireman, the teacher. Everyone wanted respect. And that's something from her own memoir, Aretha From These Roots. So powerful female empowerment. And also, by the way, there were so many songs. Like, I Googled like feminist anthems and it was like Roar by Katy Perry. I'm like, okay, I don't think that's feminine rage. But also, there's like a two bridge points of like feminist songs of I'm mad or let's go, girls. We got this.
Yeah.
So I could have taken it in that direction.
I get that. Like Shania Twain. Let's go,
man,
girls.
I feel like a woman. Dun, dun, yes. Na, na, na. Another one, we talked about it earlier this week again, but I want to talk a little bit more about it, was The Pill by Loretta Lynn. In 1975, she was one of the biggest stars in country music when she released a song that was quickly banned by many country radio stations called The Pill, which was an ode to birth control and sexual freedom that shocked the industry and many of the genre's more conservative lyrics. With lyrics like, this old maternity dress I've got is going in the garbage. The clothes I'm wearing from now on won't take up so much yardage. Mini skirts, hot pants, and a few fancy frills. Yeah, I'm making up for all those years since I've got the pill. Despite the controversy, though, it did end up peaking at number 70 on the Hot 100. So it wasn't huge, but like it hit something. But as conservative social norms have ossified around the country music establishment, The Pill is still forgotten nearly 50 years since it was released, which I think is crazy. And the song apparently was only played just once by a country radio station in the US in 2002, even though it is considered a classic of the genre. The song and Lynn's career as a provocative lyricist serve as a reminder that it's a very, we've talked a lot about country music. Oh, we have an episode coming out next month that I'm very excited about where we talk about the establishment of country music a little bit more. What I thought was interesting, though, so she was a pretty constant presence on the country charts between 1970 and 1974. She had a dozen songs hit the Billboard top US country top five, and she would sing a lot about celebrations of like humble country life. She was also widely celebrated for breathing life and humor into dangerous topics, whether it be cheating, female lust, or violent revenge. After writing The Pill, she told Time that she didn't think it was out of line with her body of work. Quote, it isn't as dirty as some of my other songs. I wrote one the other day that is so dirty that I have to close my eyes when I sing it. The song lyrics and facts argue that birth control enables the song's protagonist, a faithful wife exhausted from years of childbirth, to be a better partner and mother. Lynn herself was married at 13 and went through a taxing period of pregnancies. Quote, I had four kids before I was 18. If I had the pill, I would have been popping it like popcorn.
Yeah.
Which is what she told
Time. That's such a good point. It's birth control wasn't, it's not made just for women to be sexually promiscuous. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like, it allows people to not die in childbirth because they're giving birth to 20 kids in their lifetime.
It allows people to make choices, like to have control in their life about when they decide to have a family, which is what the bell jar was talking about, where it's like she felt so powerless that she felt no control of her life because
there was no way to control it. Yeah. No, it's a wonderful thing. And no, I don't feel like it's out of touch with any of the other songs, especially when you said what she writes about. I'm like,
especially when there's songs about like murdering your husband, which is another thing that country music in general, before he cheats, Carrie Underwood. Slashed a horn in all four tires. Maybe next time he'll think before he cheats. Oh my gosh,
that made me realize I have a country playlist that's literally just called Men Are Trash, and it's for those songs.
Oh my gosh, would you please share some with the class?
I will, because I realized that it was like a thing, and I was like, this is funny. Because I'm sure you've seen the memes. It's like, why are men's country songs always about, oh, my dog died, my truck, my wife left me, and then women's are like, oh, I killed my husband. Okay, so we've got Consider Me Gone by Reba McEntire. I love this one, Best Days of Your Life by Kelly Pickler.
Yeah.
So good. Taylor Swift is also in that. Before He Cheats, Carrie Underwood, Goodbye Earl by The Chicks, Mama's Broken Heart, Miranda Lambert.
I love Mama's Broken Heart.
Picture to Burn, Taylor Swift.
Classic.
White Liar, Miranda Lambert. Cheater, Joey and Rory. Have you heard that one?
Nice. No, I haven't actually.
It's funny. I'm trying to think of some of the other ones. Oh, I actually have some by men too. He Ain't Worth Missing by Toby Keith. She Won't Be Lonely Long by Clay Walker.
Mm-hmm.
That one's funny. And She's Not the Cheating Kind by Brooks and Dunn. So there you go. This is a more recent one, Jim Jack or Jose.
Oh,
it's like the TikTok one by Montana Taylor. And then also another one, You Can Have Him, Jolene by Chapel Heart.
Nice.
Yeah. So it's basically saying if my man can't stay faithful, then he is yours. But anyway, they're fun. I love the country genre of men are horrible and here's why.
Horrible.
I think it's funny.
Those women are pissed, as they should be.
Yeah.
Some quick little suggestions of songs I found is the song Don't Touch My Hair by Solange, a great one. Another one, we have a whole episode on it, is Dolly Parton's 9 to 5, which is an anti-capitalist, anti-patriarchal anthem in the guise of a funky little hit, which also I think is a feminine rage movie, because you haven't seen 9 to 5 yet, have you?
Yeah, we watched it for our episode.
Duh.
We watched the movie and the documentary too, actually.
Yes, where they like plot to kill their boss.
Yep.
Iconic.
He deserved it.
Yeah, he was sexist.
Yeah, he was horrible.
Oops. There's another And Just Because I'm a Woman by Dolly Parton. I feel like Dolly Parton's another one which has some subtle ones.
She sneaks it in there.
Another one, Nameless and Faceless by Courtney Love. Another person we talked about a little bit this week. The chorus is, men are scared that women will laugh at them. I want to walk through the park in the dark. Women are scared that men will kill them. I hold my keys between my fingers. Something that I thought was interesting is the chorus borrows a quote from Margaret Atwood's novel, The Handmaid's Tale. Quote, I thought it was such an interesting sentence, a really powerful way to say something so strong. I didn't realize until I watched Handmaid's Tale that Margaret Atwood had said it. And I think that it's men are scared that women will laugh at them. I think that's the line.
Oh, yeah. That quote that it's like, men are scared that women will laugh at them. Women are scared that men will kill them.
Yeah. Some other ones that are What's Up by Four Non Blondes, Ain't No Use by Nina Simone, Rebel Girl, of course, by Bikini Kill. We have a lot about Riot Girl. Mm-hmm. Even just at the beginning of the year, we did a Women in Rock month, honestly, in January. And we talked a lot about the whole book, She's a Badass, talked a lot. And a lot of those songs were very angry and referenced Bikini Kill as a inspiration for them.
Yeah.
There's also an artist named Delilah Bond who has songs called Dead Men Don't Rape, I Wish a Bitch Would, and War on Women. I also want to talk about the song F You by Lily Allen.
Oh, yeah.
So it's a song by Lily Allen from her second album, It's Not Me, It's You. Its lyrics dismiss and ridicule a bigoted antagonist, criticizing their racism, homophobia, and warmongering. The song was written by her and Greg Kirsten wrote, and Alan wrote, we are the youth. We can make coolness for our future. It's up to us. Go green and hate. I guess it has a reference to Batman, but according to NME and Rolling Stone magazine, the song is a protest against George W. Bush. At a concert on April 2nd, 2009 at the Wiltern Theater in LA, she stated that the song was about Bush. At a concert in Sao Paulo, Brazil, she stated it was originally written about this effing arsehole who used to be the president of the United States of America. His name is George W. Bush. It's so funny.
Wow.
Urban Review states that it was originally inspired by the far-right British National Party, adding Alan now feels the track is relevant everywhere now, so has removed a particular target. At the 2009 Glastonbury Festival, prior to performing the song, she made reference to the elections to the European Parliament that has commenced 3 weeks earlier, in which the British National Party gained their first upper representative seats, citing this reason to sing the song. Also, Olivia Rodrigo did a cover of it at Glastonbury that was...
With her, I think, right?
Oh,
they sing it together. Yeah, it was in our newsletter. It's a reminder to sign up for our newsletter. But yeah, she sang with her. She brought her out, and then they called out the Supreme Court for their decision to overturn Roe v. Wade.
Some lyrics include, so you say it's not okay to be gay? I think you're just evil. You're just some racist who can't tie my laces. Your point of view is medieval. And you say you think we need to go to war. Well, you're already in one because it's people like you that need to get slew. No one wants your opinion. Pretty funny song. Yeah. That was also funny. One that, like, I think as a teenager, I listened to that one being like, haha, F you, my ex-boyfriend. And yeah. Then now I'm like, oh, that's what it's about.
Yeah.
I have another song that's oddly inspired by George W. Bush. So
I was too young. I don't even know what happened,
Yeah. You know what? I'm really glad for George W. Bush because now we have these two songs.
I know. So there you go.
Everyone has something good that they bring to the world.
Even if it's inspiration. Yeah.
Literally. So we talked about the Dixie Chicks, and Goodbye Earl is a good feminine rage song. Mm-hmm. But I want to talk about Not Ready to Make Nice, which is a song that was put out by the Dixie Chicks that was released in 2006 as the first single from the band's seventh studio album, Taking the Long Way. They wrote the song in response to the backlash they experienced in 2003 after criticizing President George W. Bush. I'm sure you guys are probably familiar with it, where controversy erupted over the Dixie Chicks in 2003 following a critical comment that Natalie Maines made about him while performing at a concert in the UK. In relation to the forthcoming invasion of Iraq, Maines said, "We don't want this war, this violence, and we're ashamed that the President of the United States is from Texas."
That's like literally the most casual statement in the world that you could make about a political leader. They were like, oh, we hate him. They were just like, we're ashamed he's from our state. And then people because turned it into a huge thing.
We don't want
thing.
This war to happen.
Yeah. The crime of like wanting world peace.
It's so crazy. Also, by the way, I went to a Dixie Chicks concert a couple months ago at this point. And obviously, they're a very political band. And it was a great show, by the way. It was a great show. I had a great time at it. But there was a moment where they did a song on their newest album. I think it was that song that this happened called, I think the song's called March. And it's like a protest song. Like, it's like March, yeah. March to your own drum. And they're talking about all the bad things that are happening in the world. And like on the screens, they had just like names of people. And eventually you realize that it's like Black people that have been killed. And so the last name that is like on the screen is Emmett Till. And so obviously it was a pretty powerful statement that they were making. And then the song after that is they covered a song that actually Dolly Parton and Miley Cyrus did together called Rainbow or something like that. Oh, called Rainbowland. Which I did not know that song existed.
I didn't
until I was there.
Either.
It was on Miley Cyrus's Younger Now album, which is her worst one in my humble opinion.
Oh, I actually don't think I listened to this album.
It had the song Malibu on it, which was a good
one. Oh, yeah, I heard Malibu.
Yeah, it wasn't a great album, but she did have a duet with Dolly Parton and they did a cover of it. Anyways, two rows in front of me, there was a group of people who were, obviously these were men who had come with their wives, who were like complaining about the fact that it was so political. And at a certain point, a lot of people started walking out and leaving. And I just feel like that's stupid because it's the Dixie Chicks.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry, they're the Chicks now. They're not even called the Dixie Chicks anymore. I should be correct in their name. I was so irritated. It's they were like, oh, I didn't expect the show to be this. First off, you bought a ticket to their show. This is their controversy. Like, they have never been a band that, like, wasn't political. And it's just like, you're dumb.
It's also, like, didn't you listen to the album before you came?
Didn't you listen? Also, do you not know anything about the Chicks? They've changed their name as to make sure they're not being offensive.
Yeah.
I was just, like, very annoyed by how vocal they were being with how upset they were.
That's
and I
really
rolled my
weird.
Eyes at them. But the show was great. The show was freaking beautiful. Going back to the song Not Ready to Make Nice, the lead singer, Natalie Maines, said, "We tried to write about the incident a few times, but you get nervous that you're being too preachy or too victimized or too nonchalant. Dan came in with an idea that was some kind of concession. More, can't we all just get along? And I said, nope, I can't say that, can't do it. And we talked about it. And he said, what about I'm not ready to make nice? From the outside, normal people really weren't aware of how bizarre and absurd it got. Dan was really good at cluing into that, saying something that didn't back down, but still had a vulnerability to it. This album was therapy. To write these songs allowed me to find peace with everything and move on." And that was, I think, one of their biggest songs was that. And again, I think it's like an interesting perspective on the fact of felt like they had done something that got them so much backlash and they still had that fear of being seen as an angry woman. And so they were being so careful with it. But I like just the fact that they were vulnerable with it And they were so conscious of that and were intentional with it. And that's something we talked about earlier in the episode, where it's like a lot of the times, a lot of media that is centered around feminine rage that is created by women, it's actually very thoughtful and it never feels reactionary. They're very much sitting in it. And we talked about in the Lemonade short film how like Beyonce doesn't look unhinged when she's smashing things. Like,
no.
She's like, this is exactly what I mean to be doing. She's like, in a way, very calm and collected as she is smashing things. And how, I don't know, it's interesting how a lot of these songs are like a simmering that is just boiling and boiling up. And then finally they make the statement. I was also, of course, thinking about Taylor Swift and the whole Reputation album, honestly, which I know she got a little bit of flack for the way that she described it in the Times article for her Person of the Year. But it truly was her own version of feminine rage, and like mm-hmm. how she came back to it is embracing the character, but then at the same time was like making a statement of being like, but I was able to find love in this time. It was thoughtful. Another song, of course, is, we've talked about a lot because we love it, is Labor by Paris Paloma, that talks about like the unseen labor of women. Of course, Bad Reputation by Joan Jett is another one. We talked about Joan Jett earlier. Mm-hmm. There's so many songs. I didn't even touch on them, but that's just some of the songs I found stories on. And
because I'm like, even I'm thinking Taylor Swift songs, and there's tons. Yeah. The Man,
Mad Woman. I think Mad Woman is my favorite version of Taylor Swift.
Yeah.
Having a, like, I love it. Of her vocalizing that.
Same. And then you've got Florence and Machine's new album.
Florence and Machine. The song King.
So good. It's
one of my favorites.
It's so good.
Don't Hurt Yourself from Lemonade is one of my favorite Beyonce songs maybe mm-hmm. ever. All American Bitch by Olivia Rodrigo is a take on this. Yes. Marina, her whole Electra Heart album, Happier Than Ever, which I think is almost like an example of the thoughtful feminine rage. Of like, it starts very, not smooth, but I don't know, confined, and then has a release moment.
I also love her Venus Flytrap.
Venus Flytrap.
Why be a wallflower when you can be a Venus flytrap? I love mm-hmm. that so much.
I love Mother's Daughter by Miley Cyrus. Mm-hmm. Breadwinner by Kacey Musgraves. Also, by the way, Kacey Musgraves put out an album this week and I love it.
I haven't listened yet, but I need to. I haven't had a good concentrated amount of time.
But it's coming. So valid. It's actually the only thing I've been listening to this week. Okay. And I was able to go to a Kacey Musgraves signing and I got my vinyl signed.
Oh, nice.
That was really exciting.
I love
that.
We had
a 4-second interaction that was filmed, but you know what? That's all good.
Okay.
Some more rapid fire. Lana Del Rey has some kind of personifying like F'd My Way Up to the Top, Money, Power, Glory, These Boots Are Made for Walking, Nancy Sinatra, Bitch Better Have My Money by Rihanna, mm-hmm. Kill Bill. Rina Sawayama has some pretty good ones like Comme des Garçons or SDFU, Would've, Could've, Should've, I think is a good one. Hiss by Megan Thee Stallion is another more recent one. If It Makes You Happy by Sheryl Crow. And The Last Dinner Party is also a recent band that delves into some of it, but is also mm-hmm. it's maybe a little bit more not as like on the nose, but
yeah. One stuff. Of our favorites, so it was our favorite song from last year, is History of Man.
Oh my gosh, forgot that one. Also
by Maisie
Where
Peters.
Have All the Cowboys Gone by Paula Cole, which is another one we talked a lot about in January when in the She's a Badass episode, because in that book she talked a lot about the creation of that song and how it was very satirical, but a lot of people took it seriously and how that's just a very hilarious thing. But I love that song so much.
Yeah.
That was on repeat for a long time for me. And I think that is everything.
I mean, we could keep going forever, but yeah.
I know. That's the thing. I'm like, we could literally never stop if we wanted to talk about feminine rage songs, but those are some cool stories from them. And just some of the art you could consume about being an angry woman. And if I missed something like major in a book, like I love that example of Anne of Green Gables. I did not even think about that. I think that's perfect and a really great example of it.
I thought of one more.
Okay.
Which I probably should have brought up in the movie part two, but I didn't think about it. The speech that Elizabeth Bennet gives to Darcy.
Oh, yes.
Where he proposes and she's like, what on earth? You've ruined the happiness for my sister. You've insulted my family. You've insulted me. Like, mm-hmm. basically, do better. What is wrong with you?
What is wrong with you?
Yeah. And you've seen, I keep talking about so many memes, but we run into a lot of them, okay? And someone
I'm on the internet.
Yeah, they brought up the fact that I love the fact that Jane Austen said, I won't fix him. He'll get better. In order to deserve me. So and I think that's why that's such a popular romance story, because people are like, no, Mr. Darcy realized. He was like, I'm in the wrong. I messed up. And then he did everything he could to fix it.
Yep.
And isn't that kind of the true romantic tale that we all want? We're like,
truly.
Yep. And then she did too, by the way. She also turned around and went, oh, I judged him too quickly.
But to be fair, did he ruin the happiness of their sister?
He did.
Did he insult her?
Yes. He fixed it later. He messed up
for it.
And really, the only thing she was wrong about was Wickham.
Oh, true.
And Wickham. That was Wickham's fault. So
that's true.
Anyway, we have a whole episode on Jane Austen too.
Wow. There's so many things that I was like, we have a whole episode on that. I don't need to cover that. We have an episode on that. Don't need to cover that. Because I could have talked about Jane Austen.
Yeah.
We haven't talked about the Bronte sisters, which is actually crazy.
We have them on the list.
There's so much to do.
Yeah, there's so much. It's also hard because I know that their books are like pretty depressing.
And long.
And it's not like either of us are like in a wonderful mental health state all the time. So it's like, how much do I want to put us through?
That's valid. I had to reading the Virgin Suicides and then the Bell Jar, I'm like, okay, we should next year, let's do a month on feminine joy.
Oh my gosh, that's how I felt watching all those movies.
Truly.
And like, very akin to music, there are lists and lists of movies about feminine rage if you want to find them. But gosh, there are so many rape revenge movies. I'm like, we have different kinds of revenge? Because, I mean, man.
Yeah, I get it. But also, yeah.
I don't know. I'm like, I don't know. I need more revenge tales about something else.
Anyways, what a fun way to end the episode.
I hope this month has felt empowering to all of you and not like a huge downer.
I know.
Because I know.
Unfortunately, a lot of the reasons why women are angry, though, are because of really depressing things that you don't like.
Yes. And like, anger is empowering, right? Like, that's so many of the quotes on the back of that hoodie are just like, it's a force that will change the world. Like, you have to understand that there's things to be angry about in order to motivate change.
I like that.
So that's the point. And this isn't going to be every month. This is this month. And then next month, we're talking about happy things too. Although there do seem to be a lot of depressing stories about women in history.
Yeah, I'm like, wait, what actually are we covering next month? Oh, no.
I think we have some more like pop culture-y fun ones too.
Yes, so we're balancing it. Yeah. I will say that next week's episode doesn't necessarily brighten the mood, but April 1st, our first episode of the month, is actually with literally one of my songwriting heroes. We'll do better, I swear. Anyways, thank you for joining us for another episode of March Madness. We said it at the beginning, I'm going to say it again, is that our merch is available through the end of the month. So go check it out. We're going to definitely be spamming a lot on the last week to make sure that everybody gets it who wants it.
Definitely.
And we'll be back on Monday.
And I do want to say, my sister-in-law and my brother have said that they're the most comfortable, cozy hoodies and sweatshirts ever. And we felt that way, but I'm glad that I feel affirmed to be like, yes, that are like, this is so comfortable.
My mother and sister-in-law sent me a picture of it. Oh, also with the hoodie too, it is a little, what's the word? It's baggy. It's tight. So make sure you size up that.
I was like, it is the opposite of baggy.
Sorry.
No, you're good.
It should be baggier.
Yeah. I have it in the item description. It's a tailored fit hoodie. Mm-hmm. So it's meant to fit you tighter, which isn't usually how people wear hoodies. So yeah, definitely size up for that.
But it's also a very good thick material.
Yeah.
So
definitely very warm, very cozy. Mm-hmm.
Very warm and cozy.
Yeah. So go check that out. We've got 2 more episodes coming for this month.
So much.
And then we will be moving on, but still talking about women in history, because it's Women's History Month all year long on More Than a Muse podcast.
Truly. Yeah. Well, we'll be back on Monday.
See you. Bye.